3336503 or visit will.illinois.edu/Illinois Radio Reader. The Illinois Radio Reader is a service of Illinois Public Media.
I'm Celeste Headley, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. There has been a lot of progress in reducing the number of teen pregnancies over the last few decades. Rates have declined across all ethnic groups. But according to new figures from the Centers for Disease Control, the teen birth rate among Hispanics is stubbornly high. Joining us to talk about what's behind these numbers are Jane Delgado, President and CEO of the National Alliance for Hispanic Health, and also joining me, Christina Martinez. She's a Head Start teacher in Sacramento, California, who had her first child at the age of 17. Jane and Christina, welcome.
So glad to be here with you today.
Thank you for having me.
There's a couple basics we want to make sure we get clear from the very beginning. Number one, when we talk about preventing teen pregnancy, we're not talking about just girls, right? We're talking about boys as well. The other thing is we don't want to underemphasize the significant progress that we've made in cutting down on teen pregnancies among all groups. But Jane, why do we consistently seem to see Latinas having the highest rate of teen births?
I think there's a lot going on with Hispanic girls. You know, at the same time that we see a lot of teen pregnancy among Hispanic girls, we also know Hispanic teens are the group most likely to attempt suicide. So there's a lot of self-esteem issues that are going on here. And something that people don't talk about but is key is that we know for Hispanic and African-American girls, they're reaching puberty younger and younger. So there's a
biologically,
so that there is a lot going on with their bodies and with the messages that people get from society that may not be helpful.
So Christina, let's take you back to when your child was born at the age of 17. What kind of messages did you get? What kind of discussions do you have with either teachers or family members about teen pregnancy?
Well, as far as teachers went, there was very little discussion. I think I can remember having one sex education class, if you will, and that was in fifth grade, so way before the onset of puberty, for me anyway, and that was it. So the conversation in school was pretty much nil. At home, my mom was very open. You know, if we were my sisters or I were curious about anything, she would have books for us. She would be willing to take us to see our family practitioner if we needed birth control. So that was an ongoing conversation.
We often think of among the Latino community, people often say, well, that's part of the culture is a religious, a strong religious background. And very often it includes starting a family early. How much did that play into your the birth of your child?
I don't think that we were getting messages so much that were encouraging us to start families early. There's definitely the values of Catholicism that we were raised with by our grandparents. And so when it came time to make a decision in terms of carrying on with the pregnancy or having an abortion, that definitely played a role in my decision to continue with the pregnancy. But we were encouraged to continue our education, to go with higher ed.
Well, Jane, what exactly do you find in terms of the difference between the message? I mean, obviously, many of these kids must be attending the same classrooms, right? Are they getting the same message from teachers and then at home?
Well, I think that what happens in the Hispanic family is that we value children. So if a young woman becomes pregnant, we may not be thrilled about it, but, you know, we will support her in her pregnancy. And this is a very difficult time for these young women. So having that support is something that is good. You know, I think that the important thing is that last year, the Hispanic birth rate had the largest decline among teens than we've had in years, 11%.
In these new numbers from the CDC.
Yes. Yeah. So that's a good thing. So more and more people are getting the message, and not just girls. The message has to be for boys, because we also know that often the boys are 5 years older on the average than the girls. So it's a message that has to go out to girls and boys.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the teen birth rate, especially among Latinas. Our guests are Jane Delgado, who you just heard from the National Alliance for Hispanic Health, and Christina Martinez, a Head Start teacher who had her first child at the age of 17. And well, let's dive a little bit more into why we want to prevent teen pregnancy. I know May is Teen Pregnancy Prevention Month. So what are the outcomes very often, or why is it so important to prevent girls from having babies while they're still either in high school or in their teen years? Jane?
I think the most obvious reason is it prevents the girls from reaching their full capacity. You know, girls don't do as well. Their incomes don't rise as much. They really can't do the things that they would like to do if they didn't have to care for a child, because these young women also take caring for the children very seriously. So I think that's one thing. Also, health-wise, it's not good to be bearing children so young.
Well, Christina, this didn't end up being your experience, right? You kind of bucked the statistics here. What happened with your pregnancy, and how did that affect your life?
Well, I was kind of on a fast track to nowhere before the birth of my son. And I really look at it that he provided me the inspiration to kind of push myself further, because at that point, when I got pregnant with him during my sophomore year, my grades and attendance at school were dismal. I just wasn't focused. And once he was born, it gave me that responsibility that, you know, I need to get it together and, you know, provide him with a legacy that he can be proud of. So I went on and got my BA in child development and my master's degree in early childhood education, and have kind of just really pushed the message of higher education for him. And he will be applying for colleges next year. He's doing wonderful in school, and that was the experience that I had.
So what do you think your reaction might be? He's 17 now, right? The same
right.
age that you were when you had him.
Mm-hmm.
And if he were to come home and say, "Mom, I got a girl pregnant."
I've given that a lot of thought, because obviously it's always a possibility once a child is sexually active. I've had a discussion with him frequently and early on about ways that, pardon me, that he can, you know, protect himself, and also having the discussion with the young women that he may be involved with. I've also been very diligent about keeping him involved in after school activities. Thankfully, my job is such that I'm home by 3:30 in the afternoon, so there isn't that lapse time where he's just kind of hanging out unsupervised. But if it were to come up, then I would have to do the same that my parents did for me, which is just provide him with all of the support that he, you know, needs, and that the young woman would need, so that they can be successful, and hopefully their child would be successful as well.
And Jane, obviously, Christina is an anomaly to a certain extent. The statistics generally aren't as good for girls that have babies when they're in their teenage years, right? That's what you were just mentioning.
Yes, that's what is so. That's why you have to look beyond the numbers and in each situation, because what forms that young woman and that young man's decisions, they vary from situation to situation. And in one case, it can be something that motivates someone. In another case, it may be something that is not thought of in a positive way. And that's why I get very concerned with these blanket statistics, because they give you like a frame, but the details of the picture, you have to look at each situation.
But Christina, do you agree with the effort to reduce teen pregnancies? Is that something you
of
support?
Course.
But so where do you think, Christina, where are we maybe missing the boat with reaching Latinas? Is it at the home? Is it in church? Is it in school? Where could we perhaps improve that message?
Well, I think it's a combination of all that you just mentioned. I think that it's essential that we address the academic, the socioeconomic, and sexual health challenges that many of our Latino youth are facing. And we need to really be diligent about enacting integrative policies that are going to address these issues holistically. So how can we help parents and support them in having those conversations around sexual health with their children? Because a lot of times maybe they want to talk with them, but they are not sure how to approach the subject. How can we better equip teachers and counselors and administrators to deal with their increasingly diverse student body? There's just so many ways that we need to go about this, but also keeping in mind that, the poverty cycle. I know that it's often said that teen pregnancy is a cause of poverty, but I'm thinking this is something that's existing before the pregnancy in many cases. And so that's something that we need to go to the root of. It's not enough to say that if we are to reduce teen pregnancy rates that it's going to solve that issue of poverty among Latinos.
Jane, I wanted you to get you to respond to what Christina just said in terms of where we can most effectively improve the message to prevent teen pregnancies among the Hispanic community.
I think the message has to be given from many different people in many different ways. One of the things people always want is the magic bullet, the silver bullet, the one program that's going to prevent teen pregnancy. And you can't have one program because each girl is going to be very different, each boy. Someone said to me, have a dance program for young girls after school so they have something to go to and do. You need after school programs for girls who are 10 to 15, because usually at that age there's very few activities, and for boys too. So I think you have to have an array of programs and activities and redundancy. Just because you say something once doesn't mean someone's going to get the message. You have to repeat it. It has to be part of our society. You know, it concerns me how we sexualize young girls and they get surprised when they get pregnant.
Yeah. Jane Delgado, President and CEO of the National Alliance for Hispanic Health. She joined me right here in our Washington, D.C. studios. And Christina Martinez is a Head Start teacher in Sacramento, California, also the mother of four children. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, if you have low levels of vitamin D, it could increase your chances of dying from cancer or heart disease. But nutritionists say upping your vitamin D level is a lot more complicated than just drinking some milk or getting a few hours in the sun. We'll tell you what you need to know. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Have you ever been stuck in a conversation with someone and had no idea what to say?
We believe that if you can quell that inner panic enough to actually tap into your curiosity, there's always a million things to talk about in any situation.
What to talk about next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
WILL programming is made possible by Hendrick House, providing housing and food service to University of Illinois students for 66 years. The Hendrick House Dining Facility, with Gold LEED certification, grows produce on its green roof and in its farm plot and supports local farmers. More information is available at 365-8000.
I'm Celeste Headlee, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. Some surprising news now about vitamin D. According to two major reviews in the British Medical Journal published last week, people with low levels of vitamin D could be more likely to die from cancer, heart disease, and a number of other illnesses. Now, you may think of vitamin D as the sunshine nutrient, and we do produce it when we're exposed to the sun. But getting a healthy level of vitamin D is actually a lot more complicated than just going outside or swallowing a few supplements. Helping us to sort through some of this, we have Marion Nessel. She's a professor of nutrition at New York University and the author of several books on food and nutrition. Marion, welcome.
Oh, glad to be here.
Maybe you can help me sort through what exactly we know and we don't, because there appear to be certain things that we don't understand yet, including whether vitamin D is causing these diseases or it's just that vitamin D happens to be present in a lot of people who have them. I mean, not present.
Not present, right.
Right.
Well, first of all, it's not a vitamin. It's a hormone. And you have to think of it as a hormone. It's a hormone that's made in the skin by the action of sunlight. And people who live in temperate latitudes and are out in the sun for really just a few minutes a day are going to be making enough vitamin D to meet their needs for all of the processes that vitamin D is responsible for. It's a lot to do with bone health and other kinds of processes. Like all hormones, its full range of activities isn't very well understood, and there are lots of uncertainties and need for more research about it. And in part because of the uncertainties, people like to attribute a lot of conditions to lack of vitamin D. And also, the other problem about it is that it's very difficult to measure the active hormone. So instead, doctors measure an intermediate in synthesis of the hormone, which may or may not be related to actual hormone activity. So it's a mess, and it's complicated, and it's not surprising that studies come out with lots and lots of different results.
Right.
Some studies show that if you don't have enough vitamin D, you're going to have more a higher risk for cancer and heart disease, as these studies did,
right,
or one of these studies did. And some of them show that it makes absolutely no difference at all and could potentially be harmful, particularly if you use supplements.
Right. Well, we only have about a minute left, but I wanted to say, for people who are listening, taking a supplement isn't necessarily going to fix your vitamin D levels, right?
Oh, no, it's much better to go out in the sun, because if you're out in the sun, you're creating the hormone in the way that it's supposed to be created. And you have to think of this as hormone replacement therapy, with all of the confusing and unknown and risks associated with hormone replacement therapy. This isn't something that you want to do lightly. It's not really a vitamin in the sense that we get vitamins from food. It's much more complicated from that. So I would say get outside, be active, eat a healthy diet.
That's Marion Nessel, professor of nutrition at New York University. I'm sure eating a healthy diet is probably something you add on to everything, every piece of advice that you give.
It absolutely is.
She joined us by phone from her home office. Marion, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
A Missouri man is facing charges for allegedly killing three people at Jewish centers in the Kansas City suburbs over the weekend. The details about that shooting are still coming in, but early reports indicate it may have been a hate crime. Hate crime is a specific legal distinction, and it also happens to be in headlines in Detroit as well. There, a man was viciously beaten after he hit a boy with his truck. The man got out of his vehicle to check on the boy, and that's when he was allegedly attacked by a mob of people. The boy is now home and recovering, but the driver is facing an uncertain recovery. We're not sure if he will recover. Several people have been arrested, and police say they're looking into the attack as a possible hate crime. The driver was white, the people accused of attacking him, black. Joining us now is Quinn Kleinfelter. He's senior news editor at WDET in Detroit, and also with us, Jerome Vaughn. He's the news director there at WDET. Welcome to both of you.
Hi, Celeste.
Good to be with you.
So, Quinn, give us the bare bones details of what happened. This boy, as I understand, ran out in the street in front of a gas station?
Yeah, darted out by all accounts and by the security video without any warning, just right in front of this guy pulling out with his truck. He hit him and then actually stopped and by all accounts was doing a good deed. He stopped, came back and said, oh, the poor child was trying to see what he could do to try to save him. At that point, people began to descend on him, as many as a half a dozen or more people, and began beating him severely to the point where, as you say, he's been in a hospital in and out of consciousness and just barely beginning to pull out of it at this point. The boy himself suffered only a broken leg. And it would have been a much worse attack probably, except that a nurse actually was watching from high above in a different building, saw the incident and went down to try to help the boy, and then turned and began shielding the driver from the mob. It was a flash mob of the worst sort.
And it was, let me be clear here on race, because we're talking about a hate crime, Quinn. The driver was white, the boy was African-American, the mob of people was African-American, and the nurse that saved him was African-American.
Correct. All the people that have been charged at the moment age from anywhere from 17 to 30. The person being charged with the hate crime, ethnic intimidation, is a 16-year-old. Driver was about a 54-year-old white guy.
Jerome, help me understand the mood of the community in which something like this could happen. What would cause this kind of reaction to this incident, which in maybe any other street might be a tragic or painful but unnotable incident?
Well, right now, there's a lot of speculation about why exactly it happened, but a couple of key words keep coming up. One is rage. I think the other one is hopelessness, that these people at the gas station saw this kid get hit, and there was this rage that elicited itself, and they took it out on Steve Utash, the driver of the truck. So a lot of people have been trying to analyze, okay, why has this happened? Does this have to deal solely with race? Did they solely attack him because he was white? Or was it because they saw someone from the neighborhood get hit and they thought it was carelessness? That's something that we're still really trying to piece together at this point. But that rage is a key part of it. And hopelessness, I think, is another word that a lot of people are talking about, that it's easy to get angry when you don't have anything else to occupy your mind.
And ironically, Jerome, some of the reports that we've seen is that the community reaction after all of this has kind of been to unite both blacks and whites together in Detroit in denouncing this particular event and what may have led up to it. Is that fairly accurate?
I think exactly right. There was a big church service last week where people of different denominations, people of different ethnicities came together to say, hey, this is not what we want our city to be about, to recognize that Steve Utash tried to do the right thing, tried to help the boy, and that the response of the people at the gas station was absolutely the wrong thing to do. There was also a call across all denominations to preach about it in their religious services over the weekends to say, hey, this is not how we respond to things in Detroit when things go slightly wrong.
Quinn, what will feed into the decision by law enforcement to approach this as a hate crime or just an assault?
Well, the state statute says a person is guilty of what they call ethnic intimidation, which is the official words for hate crime, if they maliciously, with specific intent, try to harass or harm somebody because of their race, color, religion, gender, etc. In this particular case, apparently the 16-year-old is the only one that actually said that he was mad in part because it was an African-American child hit by a white person. The other four that have been arrested so far and charged with assault with intent to murder have never made those claims. So that was why the prosecutor brought this particular hate crime charge on the 16-year-old, because he was the one who was turned in by his parents, by the way. Because he was the one that said that I was mad in part because it was a white guy.
Jerome, we already know, for many people who watch the news in Detroit, we know that there is often a schism between Detroit itself and its surrounding suburbs. Is there a fear that this could make it worse? Could it be play out in the suburbs that Detroit is not safe for white people?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the right word. Fear is predominant in this situation in a number of ways. There's fears that people who have racial stereotypes will use this to confirm their stereotypes. See, there's a reason I don't go to Detroit, or there's a reason that this race acts the way it does. And there's a real fear about that. You know, this racial baiting really mushroomed on the web in the days afterwards. And really, there was a lot of calling. Why isn't this a hate crime? Why isn't this a hate crime by whites against calling for African Americans to be charged with a hate crime? So there's been a lot of that going on. I think there's a lot of fear that this is going to mushroom out of control in a number of other ways, in that folks in the city are very angry. The city is dealing with the bankruptcy. The area is changing very rapidly, and there's a lot of uncertainty going on. And I think that's why there was such a strong reaction right away from individual citizens, as well as from law enforcement and from city officials, to say, hey, this is not the way to go. And it's really started to have an impact.
And Quinn, we only have a minute left, but when might we see this go to trial for these defendants?
They're coming back at the end of April for some more hearings to see where it will go from there. And from that point on, it depends. You know, it's not unique that an African-American is charged with hate crimes. There were several who were charged in the wake of the Trayvon Martin incident. But at the same time, it is something that's somewhat unusual. And so, you know, where it goes from here and whether any of those types of charges are applied to anybody else, you know, and the old cliche remains to be seen.
Quinn Kleinfelter is senior news editor at WDET in Detroit, and Jerome Vaughn is the news director there. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you, Celeste.
Always good to be with you.
Mavis Staples has one of those voices that makes you stop and listen.
I know what the ladies. Ain't nobody crying.
That's Mavis Staples singing with her father and her sisters, the Staples Singers. They had number one hits on the Billboard charts, but they also helped craft a soundtrack for the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 60s. She talked about that aspect of her career last week at an event in Austin, Texas, marking the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. NPR's Don Gagne was there.
It was called the Civil Rights Summit at the LBJ Presidential Library. As these things go, this one was a pretty big deal. Four presidents attended: Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama. Veterans of the civil rights struggles, like John Lewis and Andrew Young, recalled the battles they survived. And there was Mavis Staples.
Why? Am I treated so bad? Tell me why. Oh, why am I treated so bad?
Mavis Staples is now 74 years old. Her voice rich and deep and strong. The song is Why Am I Treated So Bad? She says it was Dr. Martin Luther King's favorite of the Staples Singers, who performed it at so many civil rights marches and rallies.
You know I'm all alone as I sing this song. Hear my call. I've done nobody wrong, but I'm treated so bad.
Earlier in the week, Staples joined a panel discussion at the LBJ conference. She recalled her very first meeting with Dr. King. The Pops, she refers to here, is her father, Pop Staples. He was the leader of the group.
We happened to be in Montgomery, Alabama on a Sunday morning. So Pops called my sisters and I to his room. He said, listen, y'all, this man Martin is here. Martin Luther King. We didn't know Dr. King, Pops. He keeps secrets, you know.
So they all got in the car and went to church to see Dr. King preach. After the service, Mavis recalls, Pop Staples said this to his daughters.
I like this man's message. I really like his message. And I think that if he can preach it, we can sing it. March for freedom's highway. March each and every day. March up freedom's highway. March each and every day. I was there and I'm still here. I'm on the battlefield and I'm fighting and I won't stop. Every concert that I do today, I'm still singing freedom songs. I'm still singing. I'm not going to let it go. because I'm a witness. I'm a living witness. You know? Yeah. Yes, indeed.
In 1961, the Staple Singers sang for President Kennedy's inaugural celebration. This week, Mavis Staples sang for President Obama before his speech to the LBJ Civil Rights Summit.
Everybody, yeah, we shall overcome. Sing it. We shall overcome. Oh, yeah, we shall overcome. So
Don Gagne reporting last week from Austin, Texas at the Civil Rights Summit at the LBJ Presidential Library.
You know, I do believe that we shall overcome someday.
Coming up, we go to Appalachia. You might be surprised to hear that many different ethnic groups have lived there for years, including Latinos.
We have a lot to learn from the Appalachian region, actually, about listening across diverse backgrounds.
The history of Latinos in Appalachia, that's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Celeste Headlee.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Sit for Life and Herman Miller, featuring the Aeron chair, including the true black color. Sit for Less is now sitforlife.com. From the Gilchrist Foundation, in support of NPR's commitment to coverage of the arts. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org. And from the estate of Joan Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, how antibiotics, cesarean sections, and sanitizers are destroying the balance of the human microbiome, the massive collection of microorganisms that live in and on our bodies. We talk with Dr. Martin Blaser, who speculates that changes in the microbiome may be contributing to obesity, asthma, and allergies. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
On the next Independent Lens, The Trials of Muhammad Ali explores the extraordinary and complex life of the legendary athlete outside the boxing ring. The film chronicles Ali's exile years when he was banned from boxing and found himself in the crosshairs of conflicts concerning race, religion, and wartime dissent, risking fame and fortune to follow his faith and conscience. Watch The Trials of Muhammad Ali on Independent Lens, tonight at 9 on WILL-TV.
Today's programs are made possible by 10,000 Villages at 105 North Walnut in downtown Champaign. 10,000 Villages is celebrating 26 years of trading fairly in Champaign-Urbana, offering eco-friendly handcrafted decor and gift items from around the world. A gift from 10,000 Villages is a gift that gives twice.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Michelle Martin is away. Let's take a visit to Appalachia now, the region that stretches from southern New York all the way down to northern Mississippi. The stereotype of Appalachia is a mountainous area sparsely populated by poor whites. But there is a lot more to that region, including a growing Latino community with rich traditions in the arts. A new project documents their experiences. It's called Las Voces de los Apalaches. It's produced by the University of Kentucky's Appalachian Center. Ann Kingsolver directs that center, and Pedro Santiago Martinez leads the project. They both join us now from member station WUKY in Lexington, Kentucky. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I think many people would be surprised to know that there was any kind of significant population of Latinos in Appalachia. How long have they been there?
DeSoto actually put the word Appalachian on the map in 1540 because of the Native American group Apalache. And there has been, in the late 1800s, 25% of the coal mining workforce in southern West Virginia was African American. There were people coming from all over the world recruited by the coal industry. So I would say there were Spanish speakers from the late 1800s, early 1900s in the coal industry all through Appalachia. If you walk down the streets of Harlan in the 1920s or earlier, you would have heard over 25 different languages spoken. So Appalachia is a much more multicultural and diverse region and always has been than it's portrayed in the media. And those portrayals are very persistent and pernicious of a homogeneous region. And that's one reason why I wanted to start this project, Las Voces de los Apalaches, to create a platform through which people could talk about their own identities and choices to be in the region, their experiences and perspectives, because whole groups of people get silenced in the region. That's why the Afro-Latian Poets Movement started 20 years ago. Frank X. Walker and other poets, Nikki Finney and many others, started the Afro-Latian Poets Movement, because African-American voices in Appalachia have also been silenced through those portrayals, as you said, of white Appalachians.
Well, Pedro, you know, one of the aspects of the Appalachian region is that it's very mountainous. Sometimes you'll have communities which are close to and yet still isolated from others. So what is the Latino community like? Do they all gather and live in the same places? Have they maintained the culture of whatever country or state that they originally came from?
The Latino community has not been isolated at all, but that people migrate back and forth to many places through, you know, rural, urban areas to different states, and they do have take their culture with them, and they really interact with the community members and whatever places that they go.
There has been a rapidly growing recent Latino immigration. In 1990, Appalachia was about 1% residents who identified as Latino or Latina. And then in 2000, it was about 2%. And then that doubled to over 4% now. Spanish is the second most commonly spoken language in the region. The third most commonly spoken language in the region is Vietnamese. And then after that, Arabic, Korean, Urdu, Bosnian, Croatian, Serbian. And so there are a number of different new immigrant communities.
So, Pedro, how does this look on the ground? There's many ways in which cultures came to the Appalachians, often for coal work. It became a melting pot of sorts into which there are specific foods, specific music that can be heard and eaten only in Appalachia. How does that relate to Latino culture? What things still survive of the Latino culture that they brought in, and what has been kind of evolved to mix with others?
Everyone shared their own cultural specialties. For example, when they celebrate, let's say, birthday parties, family gatherings, Latinos with non-Latinos in the Appalachian region, they always share different foods so that everyone can enjoy.
Well, let me move on to this a bit of this music here. I wanted to talk about the theater show that you mentioned. The University of Kentucky produced a theater show and a concert this past weekend. It's part of this project, Las Voces de los Apalaches, and it includes music from the group Appalatin. So we want to give people a taste of their music. Here's a clip from the song Shady Grove.
Shady Grove, my little, Shady Grove, my darling, Shady Grove, my true love. I'm going back to Harlem.
Pedro, what can you tell us about this group and how they formed?
The roots are bridging music from Latin American and Appalachian folk traditions. They use many instruments and wooden flutes and the congas, the bongos, cajun, cajon. This is like a drum kind of type of instrument. And a charango is an Andean string instrument that they use in their music. And the band members are from Kentucky, Nicaragua, Ecuador, Australia, Mexico, and Guatemala.
It's almost like I'm surprised to hear them say Vámonos, because it sounds so much like folk music. It sounds so much like what we associate with very traditional Appalachian music. And then they say Vámonos. That's surprising to me. What are we hearing when we listen to them?
I would say Appalachian music itself is fusion music. The banjo has African roots, and all of the immigrant groups that I spoke about earlier contributed to the music of Appalachia. And so I think anytime artists get together from the Andes, from the Himalayas, from the Appalachians, there are a lot of different folk and musical traditions that have a synergy.
What's the greater benefit outside the Appalachians for someone living in Utah, for example? Why is it important that they know that the Appalachians are diverse? What difference does that make to the rest of the country?
Over and over again, people have talked about what it's like to be known as a person, not as a category of identity. And in Appalachia, there's a really long tradition of that. So in the coal camps, where people were living together in really close quarters from a lot of different linguistic backgrounds, they were not segregated in some camps in times when the region around them was segregated. And so I think we have a lot to learn from the Appalachian region, actually, about listening across diverse backgrounds.
And King Solver is the director of the Appalachian Center and Appalachian Studies Program at the University of Kentucky. And Pedro Santiago Martinez leads the Las Voces de los Apalaches project. Thanks to both of you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's college admission season, so this spring, along with NPR's Morning Edition, we're bringing you stories to help you navigate the higher education money maze. One of the most daunting parts of that maze is deciding whether to take on massive student loans to pay for college. Americans reportedly owe $1 trillion in student loans. But looking down the road, what happens when somebody can't pay or won't pay? To find out, I spoke earlier with Sandy Baum. She's a senior fellow at the Urban Institute, and I started by asking her how big this problem really is.
Well, the first issue is that the trillion-dollar number can be somewhat misleading, because what really matters is how much individual students owe, and it also really matters whether they owe the federal government or whether they have private student loans. More students have been defaulting in this bad economy, just as more people are defaulting on all of their loans.
All right, well, let's kind of pick apart your answer there. Let's talk first about the difference between somebody who gets student loans from the government and those who get a private loan from, say, a bank. What's the difference?
If you have a federal student loan, then you are borrowing from the federal government. And if you can't pay, there are provisions. You could be in an income-based repayment plan that guarantees that your payments will not be bigger than you can afford. There are also provisions for deferment, so you don't have to pay if you're in school, and you don't have to pay if you can't afford it under forbearance. If you have a private student loan, it's between you and the bank or Sallie Mae. It's between you and the lender, and they may or may not be cooperative in helping you to defer those payments when you're unemployed or your wages are low.
I have to assume, Sandy, and I'm a person who is still paying my student loan in my 40s, I have to assume that were the restrictions governing student loans not so very tight, that we wouldn't have so many people defaulting. And what I mean by that is you can't get rid of your student loan once you have it. Even if you go bankrupt, right? You can't get rid of your student loan.
It is possible to get rid of your student loans in bankruptcy, but very, very difficult. And that applies to both federal student loans and private student loans. And you're right that there would be fewer people defaulting if they were dischargeable in bankruptcy. But again, for federal student loans, people really should not have to default if they can figure out, and there are some bureaucratic hurdles, how to get into the appropriate repayment plan. People with private student loans, and many people borrowed private student loans 5 or 6 years ago. Fewer people are doing that now. But those are a bigger problem. And those, if they were dischargeable in bankruptcy, that would make a big difference.
And the other thing that you can't do, especially for a private loan, is refinance it.
Well, some private lenders do allow you to refinance, and the federal government, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, is pressuring private lenders to allow students to refinance, but it is very difficult. Students should really think hard before they take those private student loans, and if they already have them, they should negotiate with their lenders. They should seek help from some consumer protection organization if they are struggling with their lenders.
Let me give you a hypothetical situation. Let's say you have a student who's a few years out of college, lost their job, can't repay their student loan. They are now in long-term unemployment. Maybe they got a deferment without interest for, you know, a year, and that year has been exhausted. They can't pay. What happens to them if they don't pay that student loan?
Not paying your student loan is a really bad idea. If you have a federal student loan, they will get that money out of you eventually. They could take it out of your Social Security payments when you get older. You really need to contact the government. You need to figure out how to get into a program that will postpone your payments if you have federal student loans. So defaulting is something that has really long-term consequences for students. It's not easy to get it to go away.
You just talked about somebody with a federal loan. What if somebody's with a private lender and that private lender is not cooperating?
Well, again, the private lender, that's when you need the consumer organizations.
The
federal government, you really can. You just need to know that there are options. You could also go back to the institution where you were enrolled when you took the loans and ask the financial aid office for help. Not paying is really going to hurt you more than it's going to hurt anybody else. And that's true even if you didn't graduate and even if you feel like your school didn't help you very much. Still, you owe money if you have a federal student loan to the taxpayers, and if you have a bank loan, you owe it to the bank, and they don't forget about these things.
Yeah, I don't think that they do. So we know, I mean, you say how bad it is for the student themselves to default. What about the parent or relative who co-signed on that loan?
So co-signing of student loans refers only to private student loans because federal student loans don't require either a credit rating or a co-signer. But private student loans usually do require a co-signer. And everyone should know that co-signing a loan is like taking a loan because if you co-sign and the student doesn't pay, you are responsible for that loan as though you had borrowed the money yourself. So parents should not co-sign loans unless they are in a position to repay because they will have exactly the same problems that a student who can't repay would have.
So when you say exactly the same problems, if you're a parent, they could be garnishing your tax refund or your Social Security benefits?
The garnishing is easier for the federal government to do than for private lenders to do, but you cannot discharge a student loan in bankruptcy. So whether you're the parent or the student, that's going to apply to you. One of the things that happens to people is that they've borrowed $10,000 and then they don't pay and there's interest that accrues and there are penalties imposed for non-payment and then they find that they owe $20,000 or $30,000. And that can happen to the co-signer as well as to the original borrower.
What groups tend to default more? I mean, my assumption, purely uneducated, is that it's probably young people who are having trouble finding a job. Is that correct?
Actually, the people who default the most are people who dropped out of college without a credential. And part of that is because they have more trouble getting jobs. And part of that is because they don't really see why they should pay. And, you know, one thing that happens is if you have a car loan, you know they're going to take your car away from you if you don't pay. So many people pay their car loans first, and then they don't pay their student loans. So people who have accumulated other forms of debt also are likely to struggle with their student loan payments.
How did we end up in a situation where student loan debt is treated so differently than any other kind of debt?
The issue is, why is student loan debt not dischargeable in bankruptcy? And one thing that's important to realize is that while it would be better if student loan debt were dischargeable in bankruptcy, you really don't want to get to that point. It's not a good thing to declare bankruptcy. So the question is really, why do people struggle to repay their loans? And one answer to that is that, first of all, most people don't. Some of the headlines would make you think that everybody borrows to go to college and that everybody who borrows struggles. The reality is that a lot of people actually graduate from college without debt, and most of those who borrow, borrow a reasonable amount that don't cause them trouble. But too many students do borrow more than they can afford to repay. And there's a lot of lobbying that goes on. So why are private student loans not dischargeable in bankruptcy? Because the lenders have a lot of power in Congress, and they lobbied for that.
To go a little further into this, I know a personal friend of mine who had no idea the difference between a private and a federal loan when she was signing her paperwork. Nobody was really clear on that. And she ended up with an 8% rate, which she cannot refinance, and there's no way to get rid of that debt. I mean, I would imagine that for many people, that becomes, I mean, that's more than a car payment, where you're getting up towards your mortgage payment when you start paying that off.
Well, of course, if there were other kinds of loans available at lower interest rates, you could take another kind of loan and use the money to pay off your student loans.
You mean
so
like a personal loan or,
yeah,
or
no
a second mortgage?
You can always prepay your loans. So that's really not that much of a problem. although it would be better if you could refinance. In terms of whether people are confused, it used to be that you could get a federal student loan through a bank or through Sally Mae and also a private student loan from them. And so it was much more confusing. Now, all of the federal student loans are direct loans from the federal government. So if there's a bank name on it, if there's a Sally Mae name on it, then you know that is a private student loan and you want to be extra careful. It is much better to finance your education without taking those loans, but it's fine to take federal student loans.
Okay, so for the people that were already grandfathered in, they're kind of out of luck.
Well, yes, if you've already taken a loan and you didn't know what you were getting, then you're already in that situation. And it's really good to get some personal advice about how to organize your finances, which loans you want to repay when. Maybe you have another kind of debt that you could refinance, and that would make it easier for you to repay your federal or your private student loans.
Sandy Baum is a senior fellow at the Urban Institute, and she joined us from NPR's New York Bureau. Sandy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Remember, you can weigh in on Twitter with your own story about student loans or financing college. Just use hashtag PayingForCollege. And another reminder, this month we're observing National Poetry Month by asking you to tweet us your original poems. It's our series Muses and Metaphor, and we've received thousands of poems so far. They're all 140 characters or less. Listener Arp Trivedi tweeted this today. Classic linen dresses spread out before sunrise. Madras shirts blend nicely too. Summer battle gear for walks in the park with you. We hope you'll find your inner poet this April and send us your original tweet. Just go to Twitter and use hashtag TMMPoetry. And that's our program for today. I'm Celeste Headlee, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.